We are born free,
and we will die free.
The time in between, though,
that's complicated.
In that time, governments, institutions, and our egos will limit our ability to find true freedom in this life. These are real stories of real people overcoming the odds, persevering in justice, and unlocking their potential. Welcome to Finding Freedom. Here's your host, John Oderman.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Finding Freedom right here on the Lions of Liberty Podcast Network. And as usual, for the past couple of weeks, we've been streaming live on Thursday evenings or afternoons, depending where you are in the country. So thank you for tuning in either on Twitter or YouTube or Rumble or Facebook. The few people who do still watch live streams on Facebook since Zuckerberg canceled out the ability to stream to groups. But have an awesome guest for you guys lined up today. We're going to be talking about, you know, maybe a little bit more of a controversial topic, but honestly, I feel like in today's world, maybe the most important topic to be discussing. So, without any further delay, let's bring my guest on for today, and we'll get right into it. My guest today is Mary Margaret Olihan, and she is a senior reporter covering culture and politics for the Daily Signal. She's previously written for the Daily Wire, the Daily Caller, News Foundation. She's a graduate of the Catholic University of America, and Mary has written an incredible book. It's called Detrans, and it's based on a lot of interviews that she has conducted with individuals going through detransitioning and everything they've endured along the way, from manipulative therapy sessions to mental and emotional anguish, botched surgeries, attempts to construct phantom body parts, and a lot of other different really, really horrible things. So she really reveals, you know, their testimonies reveal a truth that is really pretty disturbing. There's been, you know, I think a lot of pushback to this book, and there will continue to be because it is presenting that truth. So Mary, thanks for coming on the show. Great to have you.
Thanks so much for having me on. It's great to be here.
So Mary, I think, you know, a great place to start here is with a controversial book like this, pushing back against a major cultural issue. Where did the passion come from for you to want to really write this book, gather these stories, and address this issue head on?
Well, I've been reporting for about 5 or 6 years now. I think about 5 years, which feels like a long time to me. I guess it isn't that long. I started working for the Daily Caller News Foundation in 2019, and it was my first reporting job ever. I had not really even studied journalism in college, but I had been paying really close attention to the Kavanaugh hearings when they happened, and I was just very moved by everything that I saw happening there and the way the media handled the Kavanaugh hearings and the way that a lot of different outlets reported on it, or didn't report on it, or fabricated reporting on it. And my experience paying attention to all of this, I thought, I want to be part of the news. I don't want to be reacting to it anymore. I want to be writing the news and figuring things out myself. So I kind of took a leap of faith there and started working for the Daily Caller. And I was lucky enough to start doing a culture beat, which is what I'm the most passionate about. I care a lot about issues related to life and human dignity. So, you know, that includes abortion, marriage, family, gender, all these issues that kind of touch on, a lot of ways, protecting the innocence of children. And that's something that I'm very passionate about. And I've met so many people recently who are also very passionate about it, which is amazing. I think there's way more people out there than we realize that want to protect our children and to help them. And so as I've been covering this beat and uncovering different stories, I started stumbling on more and more testimonies from detransitioners. Mm. And when I first started hearing about them, I didn't really know what a detransitioner was. They didn't have a name yet. We were just, knowing them as, you know, former transgender people, which I would actually disagree with that label now, you know, because I don't believe that they ever actually were transgender. I believe that these were people that were duped by the medical system and their therapists and doctors into thinking they were transgender. And then they ultimately detransitioned. And so I started stumbling on these accounts of some of these people. And I was in a Twitter Spaces event with some of them a couple years ago. It was just me. I was a reporter, only reporter in there listening to these stories of all these people who had tried to undergo hormonal transitions to become a different gender. And they were sharing their stories. And I was like, this is out of a sci-fi movie. Like the things that these people are sharing, I've never heard of anything like this. The mental and physical side effects. And I listened that night and thought, okay, these people are all anonymous, but eventually I want to write about this and share their stories with the world so that people can understand what they've been through. And so when I got the opportunity to write a book and I was asked, what do you want to write it on? I immediately knew what I wanted to write it on. And I started calling up the detransitioners that I knew and saying, can you be part of this? Because I think this is really important to share your story with the world. And that's kind of how we got here.
Yeah. And I mean, it takes a lot of, I think, guts, both on your part and on the detransitioners' part to speak out, right? Because you know, this isn't something that you see being covered in the mainstream news, right? This part of the story, those who have gone down this path, and right, I agree with you, they've been duped down this path to believe that they're able to detransition. So have you seen, you know, in this time since you've written the book, have you seen pushback?
Not that much, which I will tell you, I'm still a little apprehensive about how much we may or may not see. But I will say, as a reporter, I have been very surprised by how much safety there is in telling the truth. And you wouldn't think in this day and age that there is much safety in telling the truth. And maybe I'll get slapped with a lawsuit eventually that will make people make fun of me for saying this. But I have found that, first of all, truth will set you free. Sharing people's stories is just sharing facts, right? You're just telling people what happened. And especially when it deals with a story as traumatic as this, there's no good way to mock one of these stories. You know, you listen to the mental anguish and the extreme physical suffering that some of these young people endured at the hands of doctors and therapists. You don't want that for them. You don't want that for anyone. And so my hope with this book is that it's going to actually facilitate compassion for the people who have gone through this. And hopefully it'll reach some of the most hateful of the pro-transgender lobby. I think that would be great, but it remains to be seen, you know. But I will say, as a reporter, I've found that a lot of the time the vitriol is not directed at me, and I think that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. You know, I think this topic, it's hard. It's hard to address it because, you know, I think you look at the people who are, I think, responsible for it, and those are the ones who are pushing this belief that individuals are able to change their gender. And you know, it's coming from the medical establishment, it's coming from therapists, it's coming from maybe academia and teachers who are driving this home. And we could talk more about that. But one thing I kind of wanted to address first, just so people understand where I'm coming from on this. You know, I do know individuals who, you know, we'll approach it this way. So I have people who are the same age as me who have children, who those children are transitioning. And the way that I look at it, I feel terrible. I feel very bad. I feel sad for the child. I feel sad for the parents who this is happening to. And I say happening to because it is happening to them. And you can fault the parents. I do put some fault on them, but also it's this like cyclone of propaganda, which has engulfed them. And I don't think it's easier for them to see a way out, and they think that they're doing the right thing. So I don't know if you can speak to that from your experience, these testimonies that you gathered.
Yes, I think parents are absolutely victims of this gender ideology cult as well. And I should caveat that by saying, obviously, there are parents out there that we have all seen on social media or on news stories who are transitioning their very young children out of a narcissistic desire to promote themselves, mm-hmm. Or God forbid, some kind of sexual perversion. And that is, that is a whole separate situation than what I'm about to talk about. The detransitioners who are in my book weren't in those situations. Their parents either went along with what they wanted begrudgingly, or they trusted the medical system. And what happens in these situations is the doctors and therapists will tell the parents, and this is verbatim, and this is what everyone is told, would you rather have a dead daughter or a living mm-hmm. son? And I thought that was an exaggeration until everyone I was talking to started telling me that that's what their parents were told. And I think you got to remember too, that we're not talking about, your average politically versed adult who is probably conservative and understands what we're talking about. We're just talking about your random American parent that's not super keyed into any of this stuff, mm-hmm. probably secular, not practicing any particular faith. They're just living their life. And then their child suddenly says that they're transgender. And the child's therapist is saying, if you don't transition your child, your young teenager, they're going to kill themselves. And the parents are thinking, this doesn't sound right. This is freaking me out. I don't want my child on hormones. I don't want my child undergoing invasive surgeries. But all of the medical professionals in our lives are saying this is the only way to prevent them from committing suicide. So it's just this horrible conundrum and a very manipulative tactic that plays on parents' compassion and love for their own children to push them down this road. And I was just speaking with Luca, one of the girls who's in my book. She's a detransitioner. And Luca was sharing that when she detransitioned, it was really hard for her to tell her mom, because when she was trying to transition in the first place, her mom didn't think it was a good idea. Mm. Her mom was trying to go with her gut, and her mom was saying, I don't think this is the answer. But Luca and her doctors convinced her mother that no, this was the way to go. This was what was going to make her happy. This was going to prevent her from being suicidal, yada, yada. And so ultimately, after Luca had got a double mastectomy, so her breasts were removed, and Luca had been on testosterone for 4 years, permanently impacting her in many ways, when she realized, oh my gosh, I'm not happier. In fact, I feel worse. And I've undergone all of these things, and I think I'm actually need to live as a woman. She had to call her mom and basically say, you were right. And she said that was incredibly hard for her and for her mom, because the mom at this point didn't want to be right. Her daughter has gone through all of these things. She's hoping that this is going to, be the right thing. And Luca said she sobbed uncontrollably on the phone as she told her mother, because she was thinking, I could have avoided all of this if I had listened to you, but you weren't equipped with the skills to convince me. So it's just a really tragic, tragic situation that our culture is forcing these families into. It's not an issue that every family mm-hmm. is well versed in. So there should be no surprise that they're not handling it well. And I think that these parents deserve compassion. Obviously, they shouldn't have let their children do this, but at the same time, who can fault them too much when they're just manipulated in this way?
Yeah, I think compassion is really important as a response, coming from people on the right, conservatives, in regards to this. I don't think that we can ultimately, win this battle and save it more individuals from going through this, if we push back against it with anger and hatred. I just don't think that's gonna change minds. So I'm glad you brought up that word compassion. I think it's really important, especially as Christians. We should be compassionate. That should be compassionate. That should be showing through. I wanted to drill down a little bit. So you were talking about, and I've heard the same exact thing where they say that line: "Would you rather have an alive daughter or a dead son or whatever the circumstances are in that situation. And mm-hmm. it's crazy that that's like the line, that's like the textbook, that's the script that they're trained to go through. But where have you found that the initial seed is being planted for these, like, where does that journey begin for a lot of these individuals who go through this initial transition?
Yeah. Well, I asked all of the detransitioners in my book this question because I thought it was really important to explore their family situations and all the factors that led to them deciding that they were transgender. And so I asked all of them about their relationships with their parents. Obviously, a lot of these young people were in high school when they decided to transition. And we know that most high schoolers have a little bit of a rocky relationship with their parents anyways, mm-hmm. Which is pretty natural, I think, when you're going through your teenage years. So that being said, multiple of the young detransitioners in my book had parents who had troubled relationships with one another. They were either getting divorced or thinking about it. One of the young women in my book had an alcoholic mother who was struggling with many problems of her own. Another person had estranged parents. So, all of them had different family situations that weren't perfect. Most of these young detransitioners were either on the spectrum or suspect that they were on the spectrum, which is fairly common with young people who identify as transgender. They also felt lonely, like they didn't fit in at school. They weren't doing well, weren't getting good grades, weren't making a lot of friends, especially the girls. And so they began spending a lot of time on the internet, which is across the board a common theme here. I would say the most common theme is that they were all spending a lot of time on the internet. And for the girls, there's a special dynamic at play here that I think it's important to bring up, is that it's not just exposure to transgender content on Instagram or whatever social media platform that they're on that is a huge issue. It's when these girls go online at the young age of, let's say, 13, the way Chloe Cole was, they're on Instagram and they're seeing all these images of women and they're trying to figure out in their young mind, like, who am I supposed to be? What am I supposed to look like? And so they're seeing these images of women. Well, the way Instagram tells women they're supposed to be is incredibly sexually aggressive, incredibly mm-hmm. sensual, incredibly scantily clad, let's say. And there's these young girls are seeing all these images of women that are getting so much male affirmation. And so they're, first of all, a little bit worried because they're thinking, I don't look like that. I don't have a body like that. I'm not curvy like that. They don't understand plastic surgery. They don't understand makeup. They don't understand, the many thousands of dollars it takes.
Filters and AI and all the different things. Yeah.
Right. Or the expensive clothing mm-hmm. or the ability to go on these vacations. What they're thinking is that is womanhood and it seems very unattainable to me. And this was something that multiple girls brought up. But then additionally, what other people told me was that they were exposed to pornography at a really young age. And we know that, I think we often talk about early pornography exposure in reference to boys because it is so just absolutely rampant among our culture. But even with young girls who are on the internet, it's very easy for them to be exposed to pornography. And so some of the girls I was speaking to were saying they were exposed at really young ages and so began viewing pornography. And as they're doing so, they're thinking, okay, and one girl even told me, this doesn't look like fun for the women. It looks scary. Looks like it hurts. It's humiliating and degrading. Whereas it looks like it's enjoyable for the men. And so if you combine that pornographic experience with what they're seeing online, these girls are thinking, A, I don't want what I'm seeing in pornography, and B, I don't think I can be the kind of woman I'm seeing online. And so then there seems to be an avenue of, well, what if I'm not? That would be the easy way out. And the transgender activists online who are already trying to talk to them say, bingo, that's it. You're not a woman. You're a man. Here's why. And then there's the affirming and the love bombing and the welcoming into the transgender circles. And before you know it, they are embraced by this community. And that's when they begin telling their families, hey, I identify as a guy. You need to call me by my male pronouns. And if you don't embrace me, then you hate me. And that's where the whole thing begins. And I'm speaking generally, but this was the experience of several of the detransitioners in my book. Instagram was a big factor for several of them. Other social media platforms that were an issue were, I believe it was called Kick with a K, was a platform that Luca says she was groomed on by multiple people, including some trans-identifying adults who were asking her for pictures and inappropriate conversations. Also, Tumblr was a huge place that Helena, for example, was hearing about transgender issues and connecting with transgender friends. These social media platforms were just made it too easy for these detransitioners to connect with people who wanted to tell them that they were born in the wrong body. And that really got a lot of them on the road to deciding that they were going to transition.
Hey, we're going to take a quick break to hear from our sponsor for today, Crowd Health. Guys, Crowd Health is not health insurance. It's something totally different. And I'm going to explain it to you in a minute, but first, let me remind you why you are frustrated with health insurance, guys. It's expensive. Claims are denied. They're actually being denied at a more and more frequent rate. In fact, 1 in 5 Obamacare claims were denied just last year. That's crazy. That's wild. And that is unacceptable. So the headache of health insurance is exactly why CrowdHealth was created. It's not health insurance. It's a better way to pay for healthcare through crowdfunding. So let's just think for a minute about some of the frustrating times, some of the frustrating experiences that you've had with health insurance. Times when you had to pay for things, or maybe pay for and take tests really you didn't want to take, maybe some phantom bills that have charges on them that don't even line up with any of the care that you actually receive, guys. These times, these things are unacceptable. So what CrowdHealth is, guys, for $175 for an individual or $575 for a family of four, you'll get access to a community of people who are willing to help you out in the event of an emergency. You'll get access to telemedicine visits, discounted prescriptions, and so much more. This is all without doctors' networks getting in the way. And of course, you get to join the crowd. This is a group of members just like you, freedom lovers, liberty-oriented, have the same values as you, who will come together and help to pay for each other's unexpected medical events. So let's take action today. Let CrowdHealth help you with your healthcare needs. You can get started today for just $99 per month for your first 3 months. All you got to do is use code LIONS at joincrowdhealth.com. One more time. CrowdHealth is not insurance. Learn more. Joincrowdhealth.com. Use promo code LIONS. Yeah, and I do want to spend, you know, some of the show talking about, you know, the detransitioning itself and that journey, but at least one more question on, you know, how this all starts, because I think that's so important. Mm-hmm. So I have heard that this often happens like in sort of like pockets, you know, like a school might have a friend group that, you know, sort of you have like a group of friends that are all deciding to transition. Is that something that you encountered through these stories?
So Abigail Schreier documented this really well in Irreversible Damage, her book on social contagion and the like absolute influx of young girls who are identifying as trans. Now, I will say the girls in my book, I specifically asked Chloe, when you were transitioning, were there a bunch of girls at your high school that were too? She said no when she was, but then a couple years later, there were. So okay. Maybe she was right behind the curve. For some of the other detransitioners, I didn't hear a ton about social contagion affecting them. But we do know that is a massive issue. And we've seen it in other places. The stats are overwhelming. But
What was the one stat in the beginning of your book? Like 42,000. Was that it? 42,000 transitioned in one of the past years?
I would have to double check. I know Lisa Littman has a fantastic study on, well, multiple actually, on detransition regret, which is, it's also the numbers on detransition regret are very skewed because a lot of detransitioners don't end up telling their doctors that they regret their transition. And part of the reason for that is, as Littman talks about in her study, they don't want to go back to the people who did this to them and say, hey, by the way, this didn't help me, it hurt me, and I'm suffering even more. And as the detransitioners tell me, when they go back to their doctors and say, like, if they are brave enough to go back and say, I regret this transition, the doctors will often tell them, this is just part of your gender journey. And that's a huge slap in the face to someone who has realized that this is all a lie. You know, it's just a kind of compounding of the absolute insult on injury and realizing not only did you grievously hurt me on multiple levels, but when I came and told you about it, you mocked me essentially and continued the lie. So it's unsurprising that the numbers are not as accurate as we would expect them to be. But we do need better numbers on detransition regret, because a lot of these liberal media outlets, if for example, the New York Times, they love to tell you that very few people regret their transitions. And then they don't get too much into the weeds on that as to why. So we do need some better stats on that.
Yeah. To dig into some of these detransition stories, is there a common theme on, you know, maybe an age or, you know, an event or something that triggers this thought, maybe this is all wrong, you know, maybe I shouldn't have done this, and the regret starts to creep in?
Well, I would say that for the people in my book, the people that I really focus on are Helena Kirshner, Abel Garcia, Luca Hine, Prisha Mosley, and Chloe Cole. I mentioned a lot of other people in the book, but those are the people that I really focus on. And for most of them, it was a moment of less of like a light bulb and more of a general realization, oh my gosh, I am not better. I'm not happier. I was told that this would make me happy and I'm still suffering. And then from there, kind of curiosity as to like, okay, wait, like if I'm not happier, should I stop taking testosterone? Would that make me feel better? Like it's not making me feel better. Maybe it's making me feel worse. And kind of like a progression like that. For Helena Kirshner, for example, she had a little bit more of what we might call a light bulb moment, where she was in a relationship with a person who had been with her throughout her, what the activists would call her gender journey. And Helena was with this person one night, and they had made her a slideshow of their relationship to, you know, as a nice way of, you know, as a present. And so Helena's watching this slideshow, and she sees herself at the beginning of their relationship. This was the beginning of her transition, and she's a lot happier, a lot healthier, just like looks better in general. And as the slideshow progresses, she sees herself become more and more depressed and sad and just unhealthy looking. And she said she finished the slideshow, or she couldn't even finish it because she was sobbing. And that person that she was in a relationship with was confused and thought she was sobbing because she loved it. And Helena eventually had to say, no, this caused me to realize that I have made a huge mistake. And it was from there that she slowly started detransitioning. But it's an incredible moment of, you know, or slow drip of realization that they were betrayed. And I don't think we can even fully understand it as people who haven't been through it. But this, you know, realization that I was told that removing my breasts would make me happier. I was told that pumping myself full of a hormone for years with a big needle would make me feel better and look more masculine, and that would make me more secure in my identity. And yet here you are with all these health complications and severe mental health struggles and feeling worse, and then realizing, oh my gosh, it was all a lie. There's definitely relief there, but also trauma, a lot of trauma.
Yeah. So you have on the, I don't know, but I was going to call it on the up climb, but it's not. It's just on the decision to transition. You have, you know, therapists there who are telling you you're doing the right thing and they're coaching you along the way. You have doctors who are telling you you're doing the right thing and coaching you along the way. And then when you make that decision, this isn't right, something's wrong here, maybe you stop taking your hormones or you know, you stop down that path. Is there any support system on the other side? Are there therapists who are helping detransitioners? Are there doctors who are, you know, stepping up to help with this, you know, this way out, this way back to the person who they were initially?
Unfortunately, not really. There's very, very few medical professionals who are brave enough to even offer to help. It's something that I've been watching because, you know, from a purely like lucrative perspective, or, you know, someone that maybe, let's just say you're attention seeking and you want attention. There's a very easy place right now for a doctor who could just say, hey, all you detransitioners that can't find anyone to help you, I am happy to help you. Just from like a mercenary standpoint, but from a place of compassion and of wanting to do the right thing, you would think that there would be more medical professionals who would raise their hand and say, what we are seeing is wrong, and I want to help the people who have been so badly treated by our industry. And, you know, for example, Chloe, her wounds from her double mastectomy haven't fully healed. And that was years ago. So she's still struggling with open wounds from her surgery. Clearly, whoever did this did a terrible job. And, you know, Parisha, for example, still struggles with the effects of the hormones on her body. They caused her to have weight redistribution. They caused her to have a different bone density. I believe it was Parisha or Chloe, or maybe both of them, that told me that their shoulders feel too heavy for their body because of the effects of the testosterone. And, you know, they're not sure what effect it has had on their fertility, whether they can, you know, whether they will be able to have children, whether they have sexual function. You know, the girls who had their breasts removed obviously will not be able to breastfeed. That's something they had never considered when they were kids. Because what child is considering that? They're not. They're thinking in the moment. They're thinking of tomorrow. They're not thinking, do I want to have a family one day and breastfeed my babies? But now, as adults, they're realizing, oh my gosh, I would have been so grateful for the chance to breastfeed my child. That's something Chloe talks about. And Parisha, for example, is about to have a baby, which I'm so happy for her for. Wow. And it's amazing. She has, in my book, we talk about how healing it was for her to start dating someone after her detransition who had a little girl. And that little girl called Parisha mommy. And that really like awakened in Parisha all these very emotional feelings about, you know, emotional maternal feelings for this little girl. And it just like really consoled her to have this little child recognize instinctively that she was a woman and that she could care for her through her maternal instincts. And now Parisha, thanks be to God, is having a baby soon. So that's an example of how there is hope after detransition and how these young people are trying to reclaim their lives and to use their advocacy to help other people understand what's going on and what they've been through and how to avoid this kind of pitfall. And then, you know, go on to live fruitful lives, because I hope they're not in advocacy for forever. I hope that they can eventually take a seat and not have to talk about these traumatic incidents anymore, because it's not good for them. So I'm so grateful for their testimony, and I hope that they can sooner or later have a family of their own and have some peace.
Yeah, hopefully they can all move past it. And that's a great word, peace. I mean, they've had such disrupted lives for many years here. And I mean, you speak of these botched surgeries and, you know, wounds not healing for years. Like, is there any, potential for, taking legal action against these doctors or, against any of these therapists who have, intervened mm-hmm. to cause harm?
Yes. So actually a growing number of detransitioners are suing the doctors and therapists who did this to them. And they're represented by Harmeet Dhillon with the Center for American Liberty, I believe, and Campbell Miller Payne. So two different groups of lawyers that have really put themselves on the line for detransitioners. Mm-hmm. And these lawsuits are huge. They name the doctors, they name the therapists, they name the practices, which is kind of revolutionary, because before these lawsuits, first of all, the detransitioners are scared to say these things. They don't have lawyers. This is a very risky thing to do. And so the lawsuits in and of themselves, just naming these people is huge. And then, someone like me can go look up the doctor and learn about them and reach out to them and say, hey, did you really perform a double mastectomy on a 15-year-old? Was she really able to give informed consent? We can ask these questions and we probably won't get answers, but we can at least have some form of accountability and remind these doctors that you are not doing this unsupervised. You may have felt that you were up to this point, but there are plenty of people who are willing to hold you accountable if the medical industry won't. And so Chloe has sued, Prisha has sued, Luca has sued, and I know there's others coming as well. Others not in my book have sued as well. But these lawsuits are a huge step in the right direction. They're very exciting. And I'm so grateful for people like Harmeet Dhillon that put their neck on the line on the chopping block to be the one to lead the way in this matter.
Yeah, I would think, a lot of these there's got to be some clear cases of medical malpractice. I mean, you're not putting the patient's overall health and well-being first. Of course, on a case-by-case basis, I'm sure there's some that are more clear than others. But
right. Yes, and there are, it's always complicated. I think right now, Chloe just got a victory or a legal victory in hers. It's not at the close, but I believe that it was Kaiser Permanente that was trying to say that she didn't have a case, and they were able to make some headway over there. And Harmeet Dhillon, that woman is a brave woman. this is not something that has a lot of precedent. I am not sure that she has a lot to even use as an example in this situation, but kudos to her. Kudos to Campbell Miller Payne. And I'm hoping that we'll see more of these detransitioner lawsuits. Mm-hmm. I'm interested in particular in some of these doctors who advertise their practices online. There's one in Florida that I've been keeping. Oh, yeah. There's one in Florida who's been, and when I say online, I mean like TikTok and Instagram. So they're using their social media to draw in young people, such as this doctor in Florida. Her name is Dr. Gallagher. And she practices out of Miami. And this woman will advertise her surgeries in the most blunt, horrifying way possible, showing her patients scars after double mastectomies, having her patients do before and after videos on TikTok. And she has a big following of people who follow her and see the results of her labors. And she'll even advertise things such as, when you come in for your double mastectomy or when you come in for your bottom surgery, we can also do liposuction to make your body look more feminine or more masculine. And she'll advertise all the gruesome ways that she'll surgically change people's bodies as if it's magic or something. And she's been doing this for a long time. She's been advertising her patients online. And I can't believe that there hasn't been a lawsuit down there yet. So that's something, she's someone I'm very interested in and I'd like to honestly speak with. So we'll see if we can get any reporting done on that venue.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's just like, what is going through these people, these doctors' minds? It's just totally foreign and mind-blowing to me. I guess let's backtrack for a minute here, and going back to just sort of the root of where these where these transition cases occur. And I just want to come back to these therapy sessions and how these young people can be manipulated by therapists. So is this something where the parents are referring them to a therapist? Are they finding a therapist, seeking one out who specializes in this gender dysphoria? Are schools referring young people to these therapists? How is that connection being made?
Yeah, I think it's kind of all of the above. A lot of the time, if a child's struggling at school and the parents are involved, they'll get a therapist involved through the school or through the state. And that therapist will often be affirming or encouraging that child to explore things if the child is already talking about it, or even if the child's not, it will often come up in therapy. Mm-hmm. And then, the concepts are introduced in the classroom often. So when a child is, talking about these things or wondering, the therapist will encourage that and pull at that string. It's also an issue of when a child or when a young person or a child is already having mental health issues, as all of the detransitioners in my book were having, they'll go seek help for their mental health issues. And that can be a way in which they are exposed to this through their therapist. And I think it's important to note too, that like, for example, if you're going to a therapist and one of these young people, like they're going to a therapist for their mental health issues, and they mention that they think they're transgender, they might get referred by their therapist who's affirming them to another gender therapist who can help them get hormones. And when they get referred to that gender therapist, almost always they're just fast tracked. It's just, yes, you got this. We'll get you your hormones. And then the next thing you know, you're getting referred for surgery. Abel Garcia, who's in my book, told me that he started getting referrals for surgery, for bottom surgery, before he had even gotten his top surgery, where he got a breast implant. And he hadn't even asked about it, but he was receiving all these all these referrals. So it's very much designed to get you on the I don't know what you even call it, on the road to more and more expensive surgeries. Because, for example, when Chloe was in her early teens starting her transition, she was put on puberty blockers. The presumed next step, which she took, was to go on hormones. The presumed next step after that, which she did, was to get a double mastectomy. The next step after that would have been to get a hysterectomy. And the next step after that would have been to get bottom surgery, and then to potentially even create faux genitalia to try and give her male genitalia, which is disgusting and gruesome and impossible and invasive. So just all of it it's designed to continue these procedures, which are financially lucrative for the medical industry. And then the hormones themselves, it's not like you just take hormones for like a year or two and then suddenly you're like a man. No, you take them for the rest of your life. So you're paying for them for the rest of your life. And by the way, they don't work. They just mess with your body. So all of this is connected, and all of this is benefiting people who are profiting and benefiting from the suffering and anguish of people who are trusting them. So it is cult-like, and that's part of the reason that I included that subtitle in my book. It is cult-like, and it is incredibly dangerous.
Yeah, I'm really glad you brought that up, because this would be a lifelong thing of taking these hormones. Pharmaceutical companies are profiting off of that. And a question I have is, so who is paying for all of this? Is a lot of this covered by insurance companies?
Actually, yes. A lot of it is covered by insurance. But you know what's not covered by insurance? Detransition is not covered by insurance.
Of course not.
So that's an issue that a lot of these detransitioners have encountered. And some of them have started GoFundMes to help with their medical bills. or they'll start GoFundMes to help with deal with like their travel and things post transition because they need help. And like I was saying before, they can't find medical professionals that are going to help them. So Prisha, for example, Prisha was going to doctor after doctor after doctor and couldn't find anyone that was willing to help her. It was the most demoralizing thing. She was sharing a lot of it on social media. It's the most demoralizing thing to hear about, I'm sure, let alone live. You know, it's just they deserve so much better than this. So that's something I would like to see is initiatives to help detransitioners medically. You know, we should be starting with stopping this from happening. But at the same time, I would like to see medical professionals who are raising their hands and want to help detransitioners who are in need, because they really do need people and they need them now. And I think that's a void that needs to be filled.
Yeah. And hopefully your book, it's an important work. Hopefully it can help to fill that void and call, you know, some brave medical professionals to the forefront here to really start to alter this roadmap and give these people hope. Right. One last question, because something did happen newsworthy in the past 2 months here, and I just wanted to make sure that I have it right. And you're on the front line, so I'm sure you understand it better than me. Yeah. But in the UK, what happened in the UK with regards to puberty blockers? And wasn't there something that changed from a regulatory standpoint?
Well, first of all, the discovery or the expose of the WPATH files was huge. This was the expose of the World Professional Transgender, I'm losing it already, WPATH, World Professional Transgender Association, something like that. Mm-hmm. These experts that are cited as the evidence that gender affirming care is right, experts that are cited as the evidence that, all of these things are good for kids. They were exposed to be aware that hormones are negatively affecting kids. They're aware that hormones can cause fertility loss or even tumors. And yet they weren't sharing any of this with the public and they weren't talking about it. They were billing all of this as science when they were well aware that it's experimental. And of course, European nations are actually far ahead of the United States when it comes to restricting this type of thing. The European nations are much more wary of these types of gender transitions for kids because they have read the room. They've looked around and said, this is dangerous. We need to be more careful. We need to be more restrictive. Whereas the United States just seems content with just plunging ahead with gender ideology with apparently no regard for science. Mm-hmm. So we should absolutely take our cue from European nations in the way they've handled this thus far.
Which is wild. I mean, to be saying that in the U.S. normally it's the other way, but yeah, it's crazy.
Right. It's true.
So we're almost out of time here. Before I let you go, I just want to give you an opportunity. If there's anything I didn't ask you about that you really wanted to get across to my audience, or if there's a certain point you just want to double down on to make sure that my audience gets the message.
Well, I would encourage everyone to read the last chapter of my book. Read the whole thing, but the last chapter in particular, I find very moving because the book is largely about detransitioners. So people who tried to transition and realized that was impossible. And they're doing well now. They detransitioned. They're okay. We hope they will continue to do really well. The last chapter is about someone who didn't make it. It's about a girl named Yaley Martinez who ultimately threw herself in front of a train. And I spoke with her mother at length, very emotional conversations. I have the police reports from the officers who found her body all over the train tracks when she threw herself in front of a train. And it's a very emotional chapter, but I think it really illustrates well what this can come to if we allow the state to become between families and if we allow gender ideology to take control of our children. And Abby has some special messages in there. Abby is the mother. She has some special messages in there where she talks about what she's gone through and what she wishes other parents had known in her situation. So I think it's a really important chapter, and Abby's story is very moving and has a lot of wisdom in it.
I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, ultimately, this is about saving lives, right? I mean, that's what it comes down to. And, you know, your book is an important way for people to learn about this, hear these testimonies from these detransitioners, and even, you know, hearing the worst case outcome is, I think, very important for people to see. And it's just amazing the bravery of all of these detransitioners who are coming forward, and you know, the parents in that last case to share the story, because it will help so many people. So before I let you go, Mary, if you could share just where people can buy the book, and any other plugs that you have.
Well, you can buy the book on Amazon, and you can follow me and my reporting, a lot of it on X or Twitter, at Mary Margaret Olihan, or you can just Google The Daily Signal or Mary Margaret Olihan in The Daily Signal, and you'll find my reporting.
All right. Mary Margaret, thank you for coming on Finding Freedom.
Thank you for having me.
All right. That is a wrap for today's show, guys. Just want to remind you, if you like this content, if you enjoyed this interview, please consider joining the Lions of Liberty Pride. And Brian and I will be announcing a brand new perk in the Lions of Liberty Pride on Friday, which is tomorrow if you're watching this live. If you're listening on Monday, then it would have been in the past. But you'll find out tomorrow what that perk is. We're excited about it. It has something to do with really what Facebook has done with our Facebook groups, and we can't live stream there anymore. So we got to find another way to reach out to our most supportive listeners. So that's what we're going to try to do. That's all I got for today's show. Please share it. This is incredibly important. Want to get the message out. So share this with friends and family. Tweet it out as well. And thank you all for listening. In the meantime, always remember to keep your head up and the fires of liberty burning.